In August of 2017, I helped introduce the world to a man that had been quietly working on an idea that could blow the wheels off the Amelia Earhart Fred Noonan story. He'd recently put out a book via the Paragon Agency called Tracking Amelia Earhart, Her Flight Path to the End. And I happen to know the publisher of that book, Doug Westfall, who had met just a few months earlier, and it was at that meeting that I first learned of tonight's guest. Once I got his number, I gave him a call, and then I read that book. There aren't too many moments in this whole thing that I can remember my exact thoughts at an exact point in time, but this one I know, because I wrote it down. A singular question, really, and here it is. Why doesn't everybody know about this? At the end of tonight, you'll know two things. One, we have an aircraft off the coast of Buca, sitting in a little over 100 feet of water, with a remarkable set of similarities to the holy grail of aviation. That's a fact, and it's inescapable now. And two, we're gonna go get it. And in doing so, we're gonna mount the most incredible cross-theory expedition this case has ever seen. They do say it takes a village. You've heard from everyone around him, some of the key names involved in Buca 3, and you've even heard from some of the detractors who've certainly shared their skepticism on what's become a very curious wreck site in an area of the world that nobody had ever looked in until he started looking over 15 years ago. We have a plane to catch. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. From Salisbury, Maryland, this is Bill Snavely. And we're live. Mr. Bill Snavely, welcome back to the show, sir. It's been almost 7 years since you've actually come on the show.
Thanks. Appreciate getting a chance to come back.
I find this hard to believe myself, given how much we've worked together, both behind the scenes and in media promotion. But as I said, this is the first time since 2017 that you've actually sat down as a guest on the show. It's been a long time since this audience has heard from you in the capacity of the kind of conversation we're about to have tonight. We have a lot to get to here. This will be an episode that a lot of people will be very interested to listen to. So in an effort to make sure that we cover as much as we can of what we can, I will encourage anyone who is listening to this to check the show's notes as we begin here tonight. We'll have a lot of stuff linked into the notes. We're not going to waste any time on backstory except to address a few things along the way. First question of the night. Project Blue Angel has been out to Buca twice now. Why isn't this done?
It's not done yet because we haven't been able to, at this point, get enough DNA results back or other authenticating information, serial numbers, etc. The plane has deteriorated considerably over the year, and that's putting it mildly. And it's amazing that we've been able to get DNA out of it to begin with. But until we're able to get numbers or further information clarifying it, we can't guarantee that it is. So far, over 18 characteristics match up with her plane, with what we found so far. Time, distance, and fuel all match up. And we're the only ones in 80-some years to actually find a complete airplane that so far appears to be hers.
Let's get started tonight. You have a new book out, Lost in Flight, Amelia Earhart Giving Cover as a Decoy for a Spy Plane. That's a lot of a title. We'll get to that here in a bit. I will say that everything in that book is sort of predicated on the site out at Buca. It started with Buca. That's where your journey began. I'd say that between the two books you've written, you've attempted to discuss both the what and the why behind what has become an idea that, in my opinion, is impossible to ignore now. You have heard the opinions of some pretty remarkable people in the past several episodes of this show. Now I will give you the same floor that I gave them. And I'll start by asking you the same question I did way back in 2017 when you guessed it on the show. And I'm very curious to know what you'll say here. Is this Amelia Earhart's aircraft? Are you any closer to making that determination at this point?
I think we're a whole lot closer than we were back in 2017 when we first talked. At this point, I have enough evidence to say she turned back, and the only airport that was still left to her would have been at Buca. So that's my best way of answering that question.
Fair enough. I want to ask you something that I don't think I've ever asked you before. When you first start looking at this and you get that initial email that says your list of initial visual similarities are all present and accounted for on this aircraft, does it take a pretty big step forward for you at that point? For you, when does it go from maybe to likely to probably?
I think it was over time, and it was over more and more of the features matching up. When we got up to 18 and when we realized that there was no other airport that she could have gotten back to, and I talked with Ann Pellegrino, who successfully made the flight 30 years later, and I asked Ann, I said, you know, if you're low on fuel and you don't have enough to make it in and you're at Nauru at the time, what do? Do you keep on flying or do you turn back? And she looked at me as if I had two heads. She said, I'd have turned back.
Let me say this, Bill. There is a pretty big audience out there that might say, well, there were a lot of planes flying around in that area at that time. In fact, there were some very similar planes, and certainly there's no guarantee. That's why they call it an investigation. I'm about to read a list that I think will make it very clear here. But before I do that, what would you say to the people that are making these legitimate statements? How do you answer that?
The best way of doing it is to say five planes went down in the Australia and the New Zealand area. Each one of them has been checked. We know the location of each one. The only one that is still missing at this point is Amelia's. And we know it from the individual fender that we've got on this one that it's a Lockheed. And we know that it's a 10 by the lens that we brought back from Buca back in 2017. So we know it's a Lockheed 10. And we also know that the three Papua New Guinea Lockheeds all returned safely prior to the war.
While we're being skeptical here, let's talk about another very legitimate argument. In fact, I happen to agree with a lot of the points being made here. And of course, I'm talking about really a combination of what the Itasca was both hearing and recording and the words of Amelia Earhart herself. We can't have both. So how does that work? How do you explain the S-5s? How do you explain the signals they were getting if she was at Buca?
First of all, let me say, I really respect Bellertz. He's a very bright, capable fella. And when he said it came in at an S-5, I don't even argue that at all. I think I'd probably be a supporter of the S-5. But what is important is to realize, go to the AANL and take a look. On the 3105 frequency she was on, it was nighttime, it was close to the equator, it was summertime, and it was the greatest sunspots that had occurred since 1886. With the latest information we have now, the actual S-5 can come in as an S-5 from 3,000 miles away. Nobody mentions that. The farthest that plane was away was 1,750 miles away from Howland at the time it went down by Buca. It was on her night frequency. Why is she on her night frequency? That was the thing that used to really, really bug Raffert. Why is she still on her night frequency when it's daylight at Howland?
Yes. And of course, we're talking about Paul Raffert, who wrote Amelia Earhart's Radio, which is a book that we will also link in the show notes tonight.
Not only wrote that great book, but was also in charge of telemetry at Houston when the Apollo 13 went down. He had to find out where to send the assets. Brilliant guy. That was one of his major questions. He also couldn't figure out, why is she saying it's 1,700 and 1,800 hours? We're about 100 miles or we're about X distance out. He said she should have had a sunline and known exactly where she was. But there's no sunline facing west. And when she turned back west from Nauru, there is no sunline. Interestingly enough, the S-5 came in. Galton was in the radio room at the time, and Bellertz was sitting beside him. It was approximately, on their rough copy, 7:58 in the morning. And they wrote down S-5. Well, guess what was happening at the same time? That Amelia actually, for the first time, came back on the radios again. At 19:12, she said, must be on you, but can't see you. At 19 hours and 28 minutes, they circled the plane. Even the Itasca has them circling the plane. Why were they doing that? To get a sun line over Boca at the time. They were facing east for the first time. They were facing the Itasca for the first time, and there would have been no bleed off from the tail of the plane. My question to those skeptics is, please explain to me why at 2014, 46 minutes later approximately, she radios back in and they indicate that it must be an S5 question mark. Is that because the sound wasn't as loud? And why wouldn't it have been louder 46 minutes later?
Yeah. A lot has been made about the fuel she was traveling with at this point in the trip. It's certainly been discussed ad nauseum on this show throughout Vanished, especially in the Boca episode of Vanished. You have a number, and it's different from the more universally accepted one, but you also have some supporting documentation on record in the form of two separate statements from both Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. We'll get to that, of course, but let's talk about the fuel one more time. For the people who may not be familiar, how much fuel was Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan flying with?
They took off with 950 gallons of fuel. Fred indicated that the night before the takeoff. And there was a chap from New Zealand at the time that was at the press conference, and he said, "You're crazy. 10% margin for error is not right." Noonan shot back and said, "Look, the plane can't weigh more than 15,300 pounds, and we're at limit now. And that's all the fuel we can take to take off on a 3,000-foot runway. And that also meets up with Lockheed specs."
And we also have Earhart on record regarding the fuel. Can you talk a little bit more about that and talk a little bit more about why this 950 number is actually the correct number?
The Brits were concerned about her flying over a number of the territories. They were worried that what if there was an airplane crash over one of the foreign cities? They were worried about a potential incident. And she wrote them back in February indicating that on her longest route, she was planning to fly with a maximum of 1,000 gallons, not the 1130 that her tanks could hold. And
right.
They approved and told her which cities she couldn't fly near or over. And she complied and wrote back to them in compliance with that. Keep in mind, too, that when she flew out of California for Honolulu on the first go-round trip around the world, she took off with 947 gallons, okay?
Yeah.
And they were planning to fill her up with 900 to get her from Hawaii to Howland. She had never flown with 950 before. The kicker was one of the heads of the airport was asked, how much fuel did she take off with? What she had said when she was asked the question, she said, "I'm flying at weighted capacity," meaning as much weight as the plane can take, which was 950 gallons.
Right.
On the 15,300. And you know they couldn't have taken off anymore because you know that there was a Pan Am pilot up watching the takeoff. She wasn't off the ground till the last 50 meters, according to his report. And he said it was a camber in the road that crossed there that threw her in the ground effect. And then when she went over the cliff, the plane was carving out circles 6 feet above the water, pretty much till it was out of sight. Anybody that says she took off with more than that is saying that Fred Noonan was not truthful. And I think he was.
I agree. You can't get much better than that source. So he was on the aircraft. It makes a lot of sense. Okay, so a lot of people have asked me about the statistical breakdown of the aircraft at the wreck site in Boca. Really, they've asked for a comparison to Earhart's Electra. The following list I'm going to read you was originally researched and read during the 2018 Chasing Earhart panel by Scott Philbrick of the Astonishing Legends podcast. I have done some work on it since then, along with a couple other folks, and we've sort of refined it. But I want to give everybody out there listening really a better understanding of why this aircraft makes sense for what we're looking at and for what Bill has been looking at for so long. So here we go. 149 Model 10s of all variants were built, all with the same overall dimensions, 38 feet, 7 inches long, and a 55-foot wingspan. Of those 149 Model 10s, only 15 of them, including Amelia's, were 10Es. The only real difference between the models are the engines. There was also an Electra 12, an Electra 14, But the 12 was 2 feet shorter in length with a 7 foot shorter wingspan, and the 14 was almost twice as long as the 10 with 10 extra feet of wingspan, so much larger. So we can throw out the 12s and the 14s entirely. The only other plane that has a similar silhouette and size to the Electra 10 is the Beechcraft 18, which was built from 1937 to 1970. But the Beech 18 is generally 3 to 4 feet shorter with a 6 to 7 foot shorter wingspan than the Electra. We agree on that?
Correct.
Okay. Of those 149 Electras, which of them may have crashed in a proximity to the area of Amelia's route? Well, Scott initially went to the Bureau of Aircraft Accident Archives, the B3A, and they collect, manage, and archive all information relating to any aviation accident worldwide from 1918 to present day. The B3A lists 52 Lockheed 10 accidents, with Electra 10s having crashed all over the world. 13 of them crashed in the U.S. alone, and another 32 of them have crashed in other regions that were all nowhere near the South Pacific. So right. That places 45 of the 52 crash Electra 10s on record, way out of range of not just Buca, but any of the hypotheses contained within the Earhart case in its entirety. So we can discount those 45 accidents as potential found aircraft in the region. That leaves 7 that might be considered candidates for anyone who has found what would appear to be an Electra like yourself. Of those 7, 5 were 10As and only 2 were 10Es. So, looking at the crashes of the 5 10As that might be considered close enough to be the plane in Buca, 4 of them crashed on land, which immediately rules them right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
Only 1 of them crashed in the water. The Electra 10A, christened Kahu, was caught by a downdraft on final approach to Tauranga, New Zealand in April of 1948 and crashed in the Waipu Bay about 200 yards from the runway threshold.
Correct. Now,
on the plus side, all 12 occupants were rescued, but the aircraft was damaged beyond repair. Waipu Bay is over 2,000 miles away from Buca and further from any other place else discussed in this case. So that one's out. So now we come down to the last two Electra accidents, and this is where it gets very interesting. There were 2 10Es, Amelia's exact model. We can rule the first one out right away. It's another crash on land due to a collapsed right main gear, if I'm remembering correctly. That
correct.
Brings us to the last Electra crash on the list that happened in the South Pacific region, and more specifically, in proximity to Amelia's route. Here is the simplified description of this particular accident from the B3A website. Quote, the crew was engaged in a world tour, and the aircraft had been prepared with special equipment. It was able to fly 20 hours without a fuel stop. Crew left Ley in New Guinea, bound for Howland Island in the Pacific Ocean. This trip was estimated to be a 20-hour flight, and it seems the aircraft was lost at sea some 30 minutes prior to its arrival at Howland Island. SAR operations never found any trace of the aircraft nor the crew. Both occupants, famous aviation pioneers and aviators, were lost forever. Fuel exhaustion was suspected, but the exact cause of the accident has never been elucidated. Crew, Amelia Earhart pilot, Frederick Noonan, navigator. In conclusion, this means, statistically, mathematically speaking, for all the people out there that have been asking about this, if the aircraft that Tiolo stumbled upon in Buca while freediving for sea cucumbers in 95 is in fact 38 feet 7 inches long with a 55-foot wingspan and it has the Pratt and Whitney R1340 Wasp engines, then that aircraft has to be an Electra 10E, and the only 10E missing in the world right now due to an accident belonged to Amelia Earhart. Mr. Snavely, the floor is yours.
I think you've done a really good exhaustive search of it. And the lens that we pulled up from the crash site, I had measured against a sister ship that ground looped in Auckland and is in a museum in Auckland, New Zealand. The backing that it fits against was exactly the same distance as the light lens that we have. The light lens that we have is carved out at 2 areas because it was blown glass at the time and it was fitted against a metal frame that was machine made. They had to grind the glass down in 2 places to make it fit on. So that's just one added piece to it. One other interesting piece that we found was the question of the possible luggage that was in the plane at the time. And it was really odd because there was a big sheet of aluminum about 3 feet by 4 feet that had obviously come down from the side of a nose on the plane. I asked one of the guys from Lockheed, I don't get it. I don't understand why that would be sitting like that. And he laughed at me. He said, you got to be kidding me. He said, those rivets rust through. They rusted through and the whole sheet came down. And so I was able to look in, and there appeared to be, of all things, a suitcase still sitting in the nose cone of the plane. And it looked to have two initials on it, and the initials appeared to be GP on it, which really confused me. I didn't say another word about it, but I asked somebody else to take a look at it and say, what do you see? They said the same initials. I called Amy, Amelia's niece, and I said, what was Amelia doing flying with her husband's luggage? And she said, I'm shocked. And she never normally spoke that way with me. And I said, why are you shocked, Amy? And she said, I didn't think you were looking in the right place. Mm. I didn't find out till later that, yes, indeed, George Putnam had climbed into the plane from California on the second flight around the world, went to Tucson and went on and got out at Miami and flew separately back to New York when she was starting her route. So it's quite possible that the suitcase could have been in there. And I was surprised at Amy's reaction.
Well, and in addition to the things that you just mentioned, the accident site at Buka, I keep saying it's unprecedented. And, you know, there's a list of things that have been observed at the site either earlier in the history of the wreck site or have been observed fairly recently or on one of the trips that Project Blue Angel has made out to Buka. Here's what we know about this aircraft and what's been discovered there this far. And I'm just going to run through the list. And then, of course, we can talk about it at the end. The time, distance, and fuel, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, match Earhart's flight path and endpoint. I don't think we need to get into that much more than we have already. The plane lies directly on the flight path in an area that's never been searched by anyone outside of yourself. The aircraft in question crash landed at Buka on the evening of early morning of July 2nd, 3rd, 1937. The aircraft in question has been determined to be of a non-military origin. Two people were confirmed to be on board by the lone eyewitness that witnessed the accident. The fuselage length measurements were taken by early local divers with a match for Earhart's Electra length. The craft has twin engines, twin tails. It has toothpick props. The fender, which you mentioned earlier, matches Lockheed's stubby fender design that was exclusive to the Electra lineup. The craft's wheel strut matches Lockheed's. The DF loop, for God's sake, was shown in to be broken off at the base in early photographs. The fuel ports are on the port side of the aircraft. The passenger door is on the port side of the aircraft. The cockpit door location is on the top of the aircraft. Early observations were that the craft contained steering wheels, but not sticks. Early divers confirmed multiple large tanks housed inside the fuselage of the craft. A navigator's table was observed in the fuselage, as you mentioned. The luggage housed in the fuselage contained the initials GP for Amelia's husband, George Putnam. During Buka 1, the landing light that you referred to earlier was discovered at the wreck site, and that light lens has been since investigated to the hill and matched to multiple surviving Electras around the world. It's determined to be a match to the specialty landing light lens installations that were on the aircraft for Electras. During Buka 2, remnants of bone, teeth, and hair were recovered at the site. Out of the 10 testable artifacts, 5 of them were determined to be of male European ancestry. And the DNA discovery has ruled out the possibility of the occupants of the aircraft being Asian or Polynesian descent. My question to you, Bill, is how much more shit do you need to see when it comes to matching characteristics before you get out there to investigate this? Why do you think people have met this with such hesitancy up to this point?
I think primarily that it hasn't had wide distribution or wide discussion out there. It's been 7 years since, you know, you and I've talked on your show. I've been on a number of other shows. A lot of people have never heard of Project Blue Angel, which is our project. That piece is understandable. I tend to be an analyzer by nature. I'm not a promoter. I don't go out and say, I found this, I found that. In fact, the first 9 years, I didn't say a word because I knew I would take harsh criticism for anything that I did say. So I tried to investigate and analyze as much as I could before we made it public. And really, the first making it public was in 2017 at Atchison with you.
That's a great segue from 2017 and 2018 and the original appearance on the podcast to the panel in Atchison to 2025 now. I happen to think that what Book of Three has become is really very special, and I've been wanting to talk to you publicly about this for a long time. It's, to me, kind of like capturing lightning in a bottle. We've now got a really impressive list of people that are willing to come together, either in support of the theory or in support of ocean exploration, or maybe because people understand that you have to start eliminating theories now, and nothing is staring more glaringly at us than this wreck site. You mentioned 7 years ago, we sat down and nobody knew about this site outside of the very small community of people that were deeply ingrained in the Earhart search. Now we're about to launch something that's truly unprecedented. And I promised that we'd get into the nuts and bolts of this to people who are excited about listening to this conversation. So I'll ask you, what is the plan for Book of Three? I know there are things that are still coming together, but can you share what you know about what the goals are and what would you personally like to see accomplished here with Book of Three?
Before I get to the next step, I should say I personally put into the first and second sets of dives to Buka. I put out $200,000 of my own money. So I'm not using other people's money in large amounts. I had a small GoFundMe that people were kind enough to give to, and I'm very grateful for what they did. But I'm just not in a position right now to want to put out another $200,000 to prove it to the rest of the world. I'd kind of like to see if some other people would be willing to go in with me to finish the search as best we need to. I called Pratt & Whitney and I told them, I said, I'm concerned when these engines get pulled up. She took off with the Wasp engine she had on her. Reportedly, they were changed over in Bandung Lake, Indonesia by Furman Gray and a team from Lockheed. Reportedly, R-1340s, which is the military version, stronger Meteor engines were put on. And I asked Pratt Whitney, what can you tell me? And I talked with the historical part. And they said, if we can come up with the engines and pull any numbers off of them, they'll have records of every single engine they ever made. Which is reassuring, and they would be glad to go through that and tell us. What would have happened was Pratt Whitney would have sent engines to Lockheed, and then Lockheed would have decided which planes and where to put them on. Whatever engine she took off with initially would have been replaced in Indonesia to be able to give a little bit more horsepower to get off at the airport at Leh, which was a 3,000-foot unpaved runway. I've talked with a number of other people that are still working on the engines today, and they said that even if it's rusty, if we pull the engines up, they'll be able to take a look at the crankshaft and know instantly, is it an R-1340, or was that just a rumor and she was still in the Wasp engines? But I suspect from everything we've heard, the R-1340s were put on her plane.
All right. I want to ask you about something that I know you and I have had very long conversations about off the record, but I think publicly it's important to ask because it's certainly an option when it comes to possible outcomes. What if you strike out? What if we get out there and we get a confirmation, but it's not the one you want? What do you do in that instance?
I don't worry about it because I have been bellicosely saying this is her plane for years out there. And the more important thing is somebody died in that plane or two people died in that plane. I want to know who died in that plane.
Yeah, same. Absolutely.
Whether or not it's proven to be, I want to know who was in the plane. And I think it's solely fair to let their families know what happened to them.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask you about the other side of that coin now. If we get out there and it is NR-16020, is there any sense of a vindication for you in that discovery?
No, I think I really would want to share it with all the searchers. And I would want to be able to let Amelia and Fred's relatives know what happened, where they finally were at the very end of the flight. For me, I'd rather know the answers. Knowing the answers is the important thing to me. In fact, at Atchison, I was the first to say, hey, if where we're going doesn't find it and any of the rest of you find it, I'll be the first to shake their hands.
Yeah.
I don't see it as a contest. I'd like to have everyone that can working together as a team to try to figure this out. It's too big for any one person. If it's found there, it won't be for me. It'll be from a team of a lot of different people that have taken a lot of courage and effort to go look at that. And I'll be grateful and glad that we finally were able to come up with the answers in the end. But that's it. I won't have any feelings toward anyone that's a skeptic, because that's certainly their right. The key thing is, I'm serious enough about it that I put $200,000 of my own dollars behind it and have worked hard at it to try to find out. What makes me think that there's a high likelihood that it's her plane is this plane would have had to have been on a long flight. They didn't typically fly long flights at night over open water. It would have had to have taken off, even if it took off from Rabaul or even the closest in places. It had to have taken off at nighttime. And they just didn't do that back then.
Well, you mentioned something earlier, and I want to highlight this, and I want to touch on this, because I really want to give people a perspective of what we're trying to do and what this expedition has the potential of being and meaning for historical mystery cases like this one. You have received some really incredible support. You've got new team members. The Project Blue Angel team, for the most part, is still intact. And you've got a very expanded group of folks from all over the Earhart case. On this very show, just in the last couple of episodes, both Tony Romeo and Tom Detweiler have said they'd be interested in helping. We heard from Dick Spink, who will play a very big role in this expedition. His willingness to assist and throw his resources behind this has been really incredible. Of course, we've got Martin Daly, Indy's Trader, they're involved. We got folks like Kenton Spading, whom I know you know very well. The interest from Pratt & Whitney in helping with engine identification. This is really becoming special, and you started this on your own. Can you talk a little bit about what that's been like for you personally to go from sort of working off in the corner on your own on something to now sort of being, you know, the biggest story of the entire Earhart case? All eyes are now on Buca. How does that make you feel personally?
In a nutshell, to start off with, when I first was looking, I was frustrated that people were not aware of what a great pilot Amelia was. She was a great pilot, and Noonan was the best navigator there was out there. So part of my search was to be able to prove to the world, if I could come up with it, how great they were. That was my original thrust. And I could not believe in any way, shape, or form, initially, 70% of her route was never searched. They searched only from the Gilberts to Howland. It wasn't ever searched back. And so I had decided I'm going to try looking, starting with the closest islands in first to where she took off, one group of islands at a time until I get all the way over to the Gilberts. Because only then will I be convinced that the entire route was searched. That was what was part of the original impetus. And I like trying things that nobody thinks are possible.
Yeah. Well, it certainly has led to one hell of a moment in time. Okay. Earlier, we talked about a couple of different possibilities. It's either her plane or it's not. But there is a third possibility that ties into your newest book, which we'll get into here before we get to some listener submitted questions. This is a possibility that has been mentioned a few times on the show, and I've mentioned it, I've championed it. I know we disagree on certain things, but I want to give you the chance to talk about sort of what this third possibility is. And that is that this aircraft could be an Electra 10E, but not the Electra 10E. I happen to know, because it's part of the summation that, you know, I partly just read, there's one unaccounted for Lockheed Electra 10E, and that is hers. How in the world might this be possible? How in the world, in a case like this, can we now in 2025, 88 years later, be talking about the possibility that there were two planes?
It didn't occur to me until I was talking with my good friend Dick Spank and also Jim Hayton, that were very knowledgeable in the Japanese capture. I listened to them completely because I'm open-minded toward listening and trying to understand. Their crew were very professional in what they did in going through the Japanese capture theory. The Milley Island location of a downed plane seemed to be an Electra 10E. The fact that two individuals were taken to Saipan. And it wasn't until then, when I was hearing Billmont was sent out to try to recover two people off the wing that had been found by the Japanese off of Milley. The Japanese had sent Billmont out to take a look at the injuries to two parties. One, a guy that was tall, thin, and blue eyes and had a mustache, and another was a woman that was unhurt on the boat. We have three different Marshallese independent accounts of the same thing. The only thing that was different was the guy had had a thin mustache. Noonan never had a thin mustache. It also said that the woman had blondish hair. Well, a lot of pieces had to be put together, but I suddenly remembered what the natives had said years ago. They told me that two planes took off out of Leh hours apart, and neither plane was ever seen again. I said, holy cow, you got to be kidding me. And then I started reading Art Kennedy's book and two or three other books that gave me additional information. Reportedly, a second plane was being built at Lockheed. And when Amelia ground looped, there were four or five different comments as far as what happened. One theory was that she jockeyed her throttles, and Paul Mantz gave her a rough time over that. And then there was a theory that the back tailwheel wasn't locked in place. Amelia had concern that Paul Mantz had been working over the plane the night before. But there was a fourth thing that I think is closer to the truth. And there was a guy named Alex Coots that was a sailor that was required to be out there at the time. And it was still nighttime when they took off. And when they went to take off, they turned on the lights, according to Alex, all along the series of apartments that were there that the military had. When she went to take off, the actual line of the individual apartments and the runway were not completely parallel. On takeoff, when Amelia had the back wheel completely up off the ground and the plane almost in flight, ran off the right side of the runway, because she was thinking the two were tracking evenly and they weren't. She pulled the throttle back on the left, which any skilled pilot would have done at that point in time. And the plane veered from being too far over in the right. And they said the left wing had even gone down because the grass was slightly lower than the runway itself. When she pulled off on the throttle, the plane shot over to the left and it pulled the right landing gear and strut off of it. Both of the struts were lying in opposite directions, which doesn't normally happen in a ground spin.
Having said that, let's talk a little bit about now the idea that this aircraft could be anything other than her aircraft. How does that happen? How do we get there? What do you personally believe happened to that second aircraft?
The second aircraft, based on everything I've been able to put together so far, according to Art Kennedy, he was asked to work on connecting, I guess, the R-1340 to the airplane itself. When he looked down at what he was being asked to do, it had the serial number for the plane as NR-16020. And at the time, Kennedy knew that the other plane that Amelia had was being hauled back from the ground loop. At that point in time, the plane were being redone at an entirely different location. So the engine that Art was putting on would have been on that second plane. Now, she was friends with a number of other women pilots, and Irene Craigmile was a friend of hers. I've got pictures of them together in 1932. I've got pictures of them together in 1933, and they looked a little bit alike.
They sure did.
And Irene also was an accomplished photographer. The thing that suddenly stuck in my mind was when the Japanese were asked in 1975, when did you naturalize Mrs. Putnam? The answer came back 3 weeks later. The woman that you're talking about went by the name of Amelia Earhart and also went by the name of Irene Craigmile. And
That just doesn't feel right.
He had never introduced the name Irene Craigmile to them, never mentioned it. That came back from the Japanese. Later, she was also known as Irene Bolin, but I don't go into more detail. I think they were two separate planes. The first with Amelia, I think, flew its regular route. And the reason I say that is she talks about when she was over Nicomano Island, she said at first, 7 hours out, I've been doing 150 miles an hour. 20 minutes later, she actually flew over the islands and you got a chance to get the ground speed. She was an hour late getting there because of the headwind. She also was doing less than 107 nautical miles an hour. It also explains why she got off the phone to Balfour when she could have been on the phone with him for hours after that. And she got off at that point in time, I'm convinced, so she could go to the Cambridge analyzers and figured out, why am I so slow and why am I burning so much fuel? She had no other way of knowing the amount of headwind, but the headwind was 26 miles an hour soon after takeoff, and it was still blowing over 20 knots all the way to Howland. They didn't know at the time about the South Pacific trade winds, and they shift. The trade winds at that point in time were slowing her way, way, way the heck down. When she got over Nauru, the police chief got her on his Ken Atwater, and she was about an hour and a half late, almost 2 hours late, getting to Nauru. I spent 12 days reconstructing the flight, reconstructing the amount of fuel. She would have been down to just over 300 gallons of fuel left to make it when she was just over halfway and make it toward Howland. The plane would have literally fallen out of the skies in 19 hours and 10 minutes had she insisted on doing that. I know she turned back because there were four more communications afterwards, which would only be possible if she turned around and got a tailwind and was able to go from the 48 gallons per hour down to the 38 gallons per hour, which is what they did. They hung in the sky going back toward Buka. And the plane flew up over the Marshalls, and apparently they filled the other plane with ping pong balls so it would float. And that was good in a way because it probably saved the lives of Irene and whoever the pilot was in it. We've got pictures of a guy we think is the pilot, but I'm not going to name him until I can prove it.
Okay.
But the interesting piece is the Japanese got into the plane, pulled out a suitcase. In that suitcase was a passport for Amelia. They also found the film footage that was being taken by Irene at the time.
Just for clarification, the very famous story, or very well-known story, of the briefcase found by Robert Wallach several years later, is that, in your opinion, the same briefcase that was pulled from that second plane?
Yes, same briefcase, I'm convinced. They took the plane to Saipan. They locked the suitcase up on the island of Saipan when the Japanese were there, and they put the plane actually in a hangar. And the only reason we know of that is because the British had broken the code and we could hear what was going on and what the Japanese were saying. And at one point in time, the Japanese said, we've got a woman here that we think may be Amelia, and called back Tokyo and said, what should we do with her? And so we knew that they had built a hangar there. And there's about 20 different repetitions of the story by different guys that were on the island and saw it. A couple of days later, when the army came in, the army pulled the plane out with a Jeep facing north, took an airplane over top, made two passes over top of it, and blew the plane up on the tarmac. The point is, we could not afford to be seen as having a plane that we sent out spying on the Japanese back then. If it was Amelia's plane, do you really think they'd have blown it up?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. So, the aircraft at Buka, potentially Earhart's Electra, potentially the Electra, and Electra number two, the second plane, blown to smithereens. We're never going to find that, correct?
Well, it supposedly is buried under the tarmac on Saipan at the airport. But yes, there's every reason to believe that they were two planes, as the natives said, that took off within hours of each other and were never seen again. And I think it's quite possible that the same wind that slowed Amelia down slowed plane number two down, and it apparently had run out of gas because the natives saw it come in with the propellers no longer turning when it ditched. I don't know whether or not there were plans to take that out to Nauru or any other place and take the film out of it and just let the plane go, or what their plans were. I don't know anything beyond that.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Before we get out of here tonight, because I know a lot of folks have had questions and they've wanted me to ask. Ever since we sort of announced that you were going to return to the show, people have definitely had their burning questions. And we've answered a bunch of those questions, I think, in the process of the conversation tonight. So for the ones that we haven't answered, I'm going to try to run through those and I'll have you answer them. First question is from Kenton Spading, who we talked about earlier, and it's a good one. And I think we did touch on this earlier, but I do want to ask you again, because I think it's important, because people will ask. When you guys return to the site for Buka 3, what's the first priority there? obviously salvaging the loose engine. I know we've talked about that tonight, and I've talked about it significantly on the show in previous episodes. Is returning with something identifying the aircraft, is that a priority for you personally for Buca 3?
Or at least identifying it, absolutely. There have to be two or three different missions with it. One is to pull the engines up and let those be reviewed by an expert on the engines, see if we get pull any serial numbers. At the same time, we need to go into the cockpit again, and we need to be able to dig down. Probably only a third of the cockpit height's been dug down so far. It's still possible that in the bottom of the plane, which is in the mud right now, it's still possible that it could have been protected from the oxygen that's eaten out a lot of the rest of the plane. If we can get down there, it's even possible that the 1055 number may still be on the floorboards. There's also going to be a lot of other identifiable information and DNA in that plane. And there's going to be a lot also of information also of parts that are still under the mud and sealed off from the oxygen.
All right. Next question from Margie Arnold. And it's a good one. Who do you think owns the plane if it's found at Buca? I know you and I have certainly talked about this off the record. What is your opinion publicly? Who does the plane go to if it's discovered that it is, in fact, the Electra?
Well, I hate to put it this way, but there's not a whole lot left of it.
Yeah,
at this
good point.
Time, it's not the type of thing which you can pull back up to the surface. It's too encrusted in the coral and it's too fragile with what's there. I think it would be great if it proved to be her plane, if we put one of the engines on the island in water that's changed regularly to keep it from deteriorating, and have it for the local community to have tourism increase. They've guarded that plane for 80-some years, and I'd like to do something for them.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an area of the case and of the story that a lot of people don't pay attention to, and we are meaning to give it its proper due. Okay, last question of the night, and it's from Paul Gimperlein. And I'm sorry, Paul, if it's Gimperlein or Gimperline, I apologize, but I'm probably butchering it. I apologize for that, Paul. But it is a great question, and it ties into something that my co-host for Vanished, Jen Taylor, worked on recently in Finding Amelia, in that documentary for the Discovery Channel. Paul wants to know, he's asked a few questions, but I think a couple of them we've sort of addressed here tonight in the process of the conversation. So the last one, though, happens to be about the Billings site in East New Britain, the map with identifying numbers that wouldn't have really been known at the time. He says it's very particularly compelling evidence for that theory. What are your thoughts on the plane in East New Britain? What are your thoughts on Dave Billings' theory and the work that was done in the Finding Amelia documentary on that particular aircraft? It is another aircraft, not in water, but on land, that is compelling. What are your thoughts on that? Is it possible?
I have a tremendous amount of respect for any of the other searchers. Let me say, I give a lot of credit to Billings for his tenacity and for this chap that's worked with him. They've worked in some hard jungle areas. I had two thoughts on it because that was one of the first things I wanted to think about when I first came over to Rabaul. With the map that they reportedly had written some information on that was with her number, reportedly, as I recall, was under some tape. When they pulled the tape off, the serial number of it reportedly appeared. Now, I know they'd called back to the States to find out anything missing. I don't know whether they wrote down that as this was missing or whether they were writing it down because that's what they had seen on the plane. Now, two possibilities occur to me. One is that they wrote the serial number down. That's what to look for. And that's why it was under the tape, you know, on the map. The other possibility is it could well have the original engine. This is the peculiar thing. If they change the engines for Amelia over in Bandung, Indonesia, then the original engines would have come off of the plane and might well have been reused.
That's an interesting predicament.
I don't know. If Billings or this chap find the plane, you know, and it's Amelia's, I'd be the first to shake their hands and be satisfied and appreciative that it's the mystery solved.
All right, this is the real final question of the night. And I'm just going to ask it because I think it's important and it's a good note to end on tonight. It has been 7 years since you've come on the show. People have been wanting to hear from you for a long time. We have this potentially very special expedition that's about ready to kick off. How are you feeling about the case in its entirety? Tony Romeo was just on the show. Obviously, you know the news about the target they were looking at out near Howland. That didn't pan out the way that they wanted. There have been so many strikeouts in this case. I wanted to sort of ask you as we wrap up tonight, are you feeling optimistic that even if it's not at Buka, that it will be found and that we will have answers at some point?
I think it'll be revealed. I think answers will occur. I think the efforts are getting closer and closer to finding it. Each year that goes by, the question is, will it end up deteriorating before we're able to finalize it or not? That's really the only question. But I would say that if we found it and the team from Project Blue Angel found it, it's not our finding. It's every single person that's ever tried to search for her that's a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a group effort. Mr. Bill Snavely, 7 years, it's been too long. Thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
You're certainly welcome.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.